In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You've found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome to the Tom Woods Show, episode 409. What a thrill and a delight it is to be joined today by Matt Ridley. Matt Ridley was elected to the House of Lords in February 2013. He is coming to us today from England. He is an author and businessman whose books have sold over a million copies, been translated into 30 languages, been shortlisted for 9 major literary prizes, and won several awards. The book we're going to be talking about today is The Rational Optimist, How Prosperity Evolves. Matt Ridley worked for The Economist also for 9 years as science editor, Washington correspondent, and American editor before becoming a self-employed writer and businessman. Matt Ridley, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on the show, Tom.
I was just telling people about your books, and in particular about The Rational Optimist, which is, although I guess several years old by now, it repays close study. It's still extremely important. The themes raised in it are as relevant as ever. It's very fresh. And as I was telling you before we went on, it's a book in which when you read it, you're learning 10 things per page. That's exactly the kind of book I like to read. I have limited time, and I don't like books that are full of fluff. And we're about to enter a presidential campaign season here in the United States, and every candidate is going to release a book full of fluff that I would learn nothing from other than I'm a fool for reading it. But your book, this book is... I've been marking it up and saying, well, someday I'm going to have to steal this from him in a speech, or this is a great thing to do with attribution. I've got to use this particular anecdote. It's astonishing the facts and figures you have. The case is absolutely overwhelming. So let's start with what I want to do in this episode is to focus on the case you make in general for optimism. That is to say, looking at where we've been in the past as the human race and where we are now, which is a place that is astonishing by any historical standards, and maybe take a glimpse into the future. But I want to walk through that. Your book also talks about the evolution of the institutions that made all this prosperity possible, and that's very interesting too. But I want to focus on the prosperity because there are so many people, I think, who are completely misled on this. I bet if you went out onto the street and asked 10 people at random, how do you feel we're doing against poverty around the world? I bet at least 7 out of 10 would say poverty is worse than ever. And yet that is so demonstrably false, I can't understand how they fail to grasp it. So finally, I know this is a very, very big warm-up here, but I think for me, one of the most effective moments of your book is early on when you're really describing a typical family, a typical person living in the, frankly, not that distant past, and the kind of life that person led, and how absolutely unthinkable it would have been for us today. Can you start there?
Yes. I mean, I set my fictional family sometime around 1800, and I say, look, this sounds wonderful. They've got birds singing outside their windows. There's no dioxins in the milk. They milk their own cows, et cetera, et cetera. But then I point out that the father is going to die by the age of 40, because that's when most people die, that the child crying in the corner is about to die of a horrible infectious disease, that the girl who's in the barn feeding the horses is getting pregnant by the neighbor's son. You know, there's all sorts of horrible things going on. And my point is simply to illustrate how we look at the past through rose-tinted spectacles. In fact, life was nasty, brutish, and short right up until 100 years ago, and right up until last year for a lot of people. I mean, in my lifetime, the average person on the planet has their earnings have gone up threefold in real terms. The average person is 3 times wealthier and is living a third longer. Child mortality, which is the biggest measure of misery that I can think of, is down by 2/3. And the amount of poverty on the planet has more than has down by about three quarters in that time. These are quite extraordinary changes. And when I set out to write this book, which, by the way, I wrote in the middle of the Great Recession in 2008, 9, 10, I was being a little bit brave in saying, don't worry, growth is going to resume. The world is going to go on getting better. Now, of course, growth has resumed. I mean, the GDP per capita in a country like Mozambique is 80% higher than it was at the start of the Great Recession just 7 or 8 years ago. Italy, it's lower, because it's still starting. Greece, obviously, it's lower. So, you know, countries can go backwards. But the progress in material living standards is quite extraordinary. And those numbers don't really capture what's happening, because we can go faster, we've got better communications, we've got smaller telephones, you know, everything you can think of goes on getting better. And we take it for granted. If something gets, you know, I mean, I complain about the this morning I was cursing the lack of a phone signal when a telephone was dropped as I was driving along a freeway. Well, 20 years ago, the idea that you could make a phone call while driving along a freeway at all was
of course.
so we bank the improvements, we notice the things that are still not right, and we look backwards with nostalgia. And that obscures the extent to which people's lives have got better. And by the way, I didn't start out when I was writing this book thinking that everything was getting better. I knew some things were getting better, and I wanted to write about it, but I also wanted to sort of capture what progress is and why it works in some things and not others. And I ended up with almost nothing to say that was getting worse. Obesity, traffic congestion, a few things like that. But things I thought I was going to be able to say, important things that were getting worse, turned out not to be true. So happiness is a good example. Lots of people think that people are getting less happy. That's not true. Wherever you look around the world, if you get big enough data sets, properly collected in the right kind of way, as far as we can tell, and of course, you know, you can't really tell how happy someone is, people on the whole tend to get happier as they get richer, and that's been going on in pretty well every country. So as I put it, sometimes when I give talks about this, I say, we're not only wealthier, we're healthier, happier, cleverer, cleaner, kinder, freer, more peaceful, more equal, more equal. That's the one that astonishes a lot of people. You know, there are everybody thinks inequality is getting worse. And in some countries, in some ways, it is. But in the world as a whole, it's getting dramatically better. Global inequality is plummeting. Why? Because poor countries are getting rich faster than rich countries are getting rich, and so on. So for me, this has been a voyage of discovery to really go and look up the numbers and pin down just how much everybody's lives has been improving, and to challenge the pessimism mongers who say that it's not happening.
All right, I have to throw in a couple of comments here. I've never accepted the maxim that money can't buy happiness. Well, of course, it can't buy a true friend. You know, it can't buy love. It can't buy certain things. But you're telling me I'm not happier now that I'm able to travel the world at will? I'm not happier with refrigerated food? I'm not happier that I can have the services of great chefs at my beck and call? Like, that, if that doesn't make you happier, what's the matter with you? Like, what would make you happier? Like, these are all wonderful things, so I don't accept that. But also then people will say, but material things aren't everything. And of course they're not everything, but they're something. There's no way I can cultivate an interest in Elizabethan literature if I'm one bad harvest away from starvation and all my kids live in squalor.
Yes, Greg Easterbrook has quite a nice point where he says, thank you, Lord, that I am rich and comfortable and miserable, because I could be hungry and endangered and miserable.
Yeah, that is fantastic. There's a problem on both the left and the right with regard to undue pessimism. On the left, you've got some of the, I don't know, maybe romantics, although it's hard to really classify these as left or right. But you do have a kind of a Luddite strain that you can find in some cases. Or it's not even Luddite. It's this communitarianism, the idea that, well, in the old days, sure, you didn't have flush toilets, but you had a sense of community that we've lost in the modern world. And likewise, you even see that on some of the traditionalist right, with Ruskin or Carlyle and some of their descendants today, who are right-wing critics of capitalism, who they say also it destroys community relations, it destroys relationships, and And I don't see that that's necessarily the case, first of all. But secondly, they're obscuring the absolutely horrifyingly bad conditions in which people lived not very long ago. They don't. Can you imagine? I sometimes sum up what it would be like to live in the year 1300 in just the word dentistry.
Yeah, that's very nice. That's very nice. PJ O'Rourke has made a similar point, I think. And you're right that the pessimism comes not just from the left but from the right, and it often, as you say, takes this communitarian line that somehow we don't look after our friends and relations and neighbors today any more than as much as we did in the past. Well, hang on a bit. You know, you go back to medieval villages, the poorest people, the disabled people, the people who were educationally challenged, they were left on the scrap heap of history. You know, I mean, starvation happened on the roads between villages every spring in Britain, a relatively prosperous country, right up until the 18th century, because nobody would look after the people at the bottom of society. And it's not just that. It's also that the market system seems to me to be a system of rampant social engagement. It's a system where you have to be nice to your customers, otherwise they don't come back. And you have to be fair to the, you know, you don't kill the shopkeeper to get the bread from his shop, because otherwise he won't have it there for you tomorrow, etc. So this notion, which you often hear from the churches, that somehow the unfettered capitalism has made people nastier, just doesn't seem to me to be borne out. I mean, just look at some of the stuff Steven Pinker documents about the decline of violence. Routine, random violence for entertainment until just 100 years ago was quite extraordinary. And we don't tolerate that now. So we've become much nicer as we've got wealthier too. And sure, we have different ways of looking after communities too now, you know, so elderly people might fall on the state more rather than on the family, and that isn't always good, but it often is good, because often families weren't very nice to their elderly relatives and so on.
Let's talk about a well-known episode of historical pessimism, or pessimism in history, and of course that's the episode with Thomas Malthus and the discussion of where population growth was bound to lead. What was he warning about, and why was that not borne out?
Yes, this is the sort of mother of all pessimisms in a way. Robert Malthus, actually, because he used his middle name, writing in 1798, said, look, the population is growing faster than the food supply. And that means that inevitably the only way it's going to get checked is by death and disease and war, pestilence, war and disease, as he put it. His specific recommendation was, we must encourage people to marry later. We've got to get population growth under control. And if we don't do that, then we're going to have to be really harsh. We're going to have to lock the poor up in such a way that they can't breed, otherwise it's going to get worse. And this idea has been taken up again and again throughout the last two centuries, that you've got to be nasty to people to prevent population growth. Well, what happened, of course, was that food supply expanded much faster than population throughout the 19th and 20th century, particularly in the 20th century, once we got inorganic fertilizer to go. And now famine doesn't happen anywhere in the world. I mean, occasionally you get a food problem like in North Korea or somewhere else that's really badly governed. But that's caused by politics, not by shortage, not by overpopulation. And, you know, it's quite extraordinary. We're feeding 7 billion people very comfortably in the world. So comfortably that the world food prices have dropped pretty dramatically in the last year again. And we're doing that while taking half the food that we grow and giving it to run motor cars, not half, but a significant percentage, and so on. So Malthus was wrong, and he was wrong because of technology. He was wrong because of innovation. He misunderstood that actually because of innovation, the food supply could easily overtake the population growth. And in fact, the other way he was wrong is that actually people would regulate their own population numbers so long as their kids didn't die. And this is the really great insight, I think, of recent decades, is this thing called the demographic transition, that once you stop child mortality, then you stop population growth. It happened first in countries like France about a century ago. It's happening now in countries like Nigeria, where the birth rate is plummeting because the infant mortality rate is plummeting. When people know their kids are not going to die, they plan small families because they want to invest in each kid. It's only when they think that 3/4 of their kids are going to die that they try and have huge families. Obviously, you've got to have birth control and education and all these things available to help people along the way. But that seems to, you know, the growth rate of world population has halved in the last 50 years. And it's heading for zero by around 2070, 2080, maybe a bit earlier. Nobody quite knows. So, countries like Bangladesh are not far off replacement fertility, which is about 2.3, in other words, where each couple has about 2.3 children on average. And they're just a little bit above that now. That's incredible, because just 50 years ago, some of Malthus's successors and admirers were saying, we've got to leave the Indian subcontinent to starve. There's nothing else we can do for it. It's got to starve so that its population comes down. Otherwise, it's not sustainable and the world is finished. That's literally what was being said by people who are still around and people who are still trusted on these things. And they were saying exactly the Malthusian point that was first made in 1798.
I had a guest on this show, a pretty well-known one. Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull was my guest on episode number 3. And he is he's doing a new concert tour in which he's raising some issues from the 18th century, because the name of the band comes from an 18th century agriculturalist, and he's raising the issue of population and food as one of these themes. And he said in a recent interview, we are heading toward 9 billion people, and he said, we haven't got a chance in heck of getting 9 billion people fed. That simply can't be done. On the other hand, we can't tell people you're not allowed to have X number of children, so we're just going to have to see what happens. So he doesn't seem to share Matt Ridley's optimism.
No, well, it's surprising how resistant to the facts this overpopulation worry is. I mean, sure, when the population was accelerating upwards up until about 1965, say, it would probably be about the turning point, then you could say this is worrying. You know, obviously there's a point at which the planet gets full, or there's no wilderness left or whatever. But we quadrupled the world population in the 20th century and ended up better fed and more comfortable at the end. And by the way, without taking any extra farmland under the plow. In fact, at the moment, the amount of farmland under the plow is falling because we're get so good at growing food that we don't need more land. We're not even going to double the population in this century. We're going to increase it by about 1.5 times. You know, it's going to go up from about 6 billion to about 9 or 10 billion. We've got a much easier problem to cope with in the 21st century than we had in the 20th century. And we've got much better technologies to do it with. Africa hasn't even yet started using synthetic fertilizer of the kind that has increased the yields of maize in the United States by about 10 times. So imagine what you could do to African maize yields if you could get fertilizer to that continent. I mean, some countries have started using it, but most of Africa is still not using inorganic synthetic fertilizer. And once that happens, then frankly, our problem is going to be too much food. We're going to be growing it from smaller and smaller acreages. Any marginal farmland is going to go out of farming and be available to return to wilderness or golf courses or cities or whatever it is we choose to do with it. But mostly it'll be wilderness, because cities don't need to be very big. They're only about 3% of land area in the world. So actually, I think it'll be very difficult to avoid the fate that at the end of the century we'll be very well fed, even at 9 or perhaps 10 billion people, and that we'll be living quite comfortably in cities with a lot of wilderness round about, as well as some farmland to grow our food. I mean, you could feed the world from a multi-story LED-lit factory the size of Delaware today if energy was cheap enough.
Matt, over the course of the 20th century, there was a debate that actually used the words optimism and pessimism with regard to the effects of the Industrial Revolution in Britain, what it had done for living standards. And of course, the pessimists argued, and a lot of these were Marxists, that it had made people's lives obviously more miserable. The conditions they lived in, the conditions they worked in had deteriorated. But the optimists said to the contrary, that if you compare their condition to what they had had before, instead of just looking at a snapshot of their lives in, say, 1820, you'll find that, in fact, things had gotten better for them and might have gotten better still if resources hadn't been siphoned off to fight wars during that time. Well, where does that stand right now, and how would you make that case?
Well, I think Deirdre McCloskey has sort of the great economic historian Deirdre McCloskey of the University of Illinois has nailed that one firmly and finally in the book she's still writing at the moment called The Bourgeois Virtues, because she takes that on and she says, look, come on, the Dickensian idea that the people who were living pretty impoverished lives in polluted cities in the 1840s and 1850s, and which, as you say, was emphasized by Marxist historians in the 20th century, people like E.M. Thompson and E.P. Thompson and so on, that is bunk, because we know that what those people were doing was flooding into those cities from the countryside, thrilled at the idea of getting paid a wage for the first time rather than having to live in a barter economy, thrilled at the idea of working indoors for the first time, albeit in horrible conditions by comparison with today's standards, rather than outside in all weathers, thrilled at being able to work for an hourly wage instead of having to work piece rates, which is what happened with, say, the textile industry before that. Was a man came to your door, delivered some raw textile, said, weave that into cloth for me and I'll come back and I'll pay you by the quantity you produce. Whereas now you go to a factory and you get paid for the number of hours you work, you know, and that on the whole was an improvement for people. Of course, it led to abuses, and of course there were horrible things going on, etc. But actually, the reason people were rushing into cities and taking jobs in factories was because it raised their living standards. They didn't have to move to the cities. They didn't have to go and work in mills. And it's happening today. If you go to parts of China and ask people why they are sitting at a workstation on an assembly line rather than back on the farm growing rice, they say because it's a better life. From today's perspective, you look back and say, wow, that was horrible, the living standards. And maybe they'll look back in 100 years' time and say, you mean, you know, they had to put up with cars whose doors opened or something? I don't know. There's going to be something about our life that they look back and say, I can't believe that they were forced to live such miserable lives. But you've always got to weigh it against the alternative. And the Industrial Revolution undoubtedly brought an enormous advance in living standards in Britain first, then in other parts of Northern Europe and North America, and now this is what's happening in China at the moment, and India and Africa is beginning to follow suit.
I did an episode of this show with Deirdre McCloskey, so I will link to that as one of the related episodes on the show notes page for today, this being episode 409. It'll be tomwoods.com/409. Of course, we'll also link to The Rational Optimist there. Before I let you go, what do you feel are challenges coming in the future that, you know, maybe not aren't going to destroy the human race, but that maybe are a puzzle even to you? And I might add, let me put in parentheses here, what about energy? Doesn't all this rely on cheap energy, and isn't that a potential problem?
You're absolutely right that the supply of affordable energy is absolutely crucial to improvement of living standards. And it's the one thing that's driven living standards upwards in the last 200 years. Because when you think about it, each of you and I have thousands of slaves working for us in the background, in the back room, if you like. They're not slaves, they're electricity, but they're driving machines. They're making us warm, but they're producing the products we use, et cetera, et cetera. But if you turn that into sort of watts of energy and you compare that with how much you'd have to get out from muscle power, which is what most people relied on for most of history, then so you would need thousands of people on exercise bicycles in the back room with no standard of living themselves in order to keep you in the lifestyle to which you've become accustomed. So thank goodness for fossil fuels, which provide 85% of our energy and so on. Now, it's pretty clear that particularly over the last few years that gas is not going to run out. In fact, it's super abundant. The shale gas revolution, we've got methane clathrates on the ocean floor, etc. Oil might run out in some fields, etc. Coal's going to last a long time. There's a problem with climate change, but there's nuclear behind that. I don't think we're going to have an energy problem in this century, but we're going to have political arguments about which kind of energy we should use. The two things I really, well, there are small things going wrong with our lives that I do worry about, like the epidemic of autoimmune diseases and allergies and things like that, a lot of which comes from the fact that our lives have got cleaner. So we're not challenged by parasites, and that causes these diseases. I'm pretty sure that's the issue there. But there are two big themes that I am pessimistic about to a small extent, or at least worried about. One is bureaucracy and the other is superstition. I mean, if you look at what brought down great civilizations in the past, it was a combination of bureaucracy and superstition usually. So in other words, turning your back on at the open society and saying these are the dogmas you have to believe was a real problem for the Arab civilization, which was a wonderful flowering of civilization and then became a benighted theocracy instead. Likewise, if you look at what happened in China 1,000 years ago or so, by far the wealthiest part of the world with enormous amount of innovation going on. And then it all stops. And why? Because the Ming emperors basically bring in tremendously intrusive bureaucracy in order to control exactly what everybody's doing at every moment of the day and ban people from trading overseas and all this kind of thing. And the result is that you stifle innovation. So there's a lot of both of those things going on at the moment. And, you know, we're speaking just as Palmyra has fallen to an unbelievably benighted 7th century faith in the form of the Islamic State in Syria. So, you know, there are things to worry about. It would be possible to kill this process we've got going that improves people's living standards. It's been done before on, not for the world, but for big civilizations in the past. It's possible that it could be done for the world. And that does worry me.
The book we've been discussing is The Rational Optimist, How Prosperity Evolves. Of course, you can get it on Amazon. We're linking to it at tomwoods.com/409. How can people follow you online?
I have a website called rationaloptimist.com. And I blog there, or at least what I do, I write a weekly column for The Times in London, and I write regularly for The Wall Street Journals, and I always repost my articles there. So that if people don't see them on their original websites, they can find them there. And I have a new book coming out later this year called The Evolution of Everything, which I'm going to start talking about shortly.
That sounds a little ambitious.
Right.
A title like that. Well, best of luck with it. Where are you in the process of writing it?
It's finished.
How about that?
I signed off the index today, funnily enough.
Well, how about that? Well, I love an in-your-face title like that. That is fantastic. Well, best of luck with that, and thanks so much for your time today. We'll link people to your website, to your book, and all this stuff on tomwoods.com/409. And thanks again. It was great.
Great to talk to you, Tom.
All right, everybody, I thought I'd give you a nice optimistic episode before plunging us back into the depths of despair tomorrow, when we're going to be talking about some of the disastrous failures of socialism. We're going to talk about Venezuela, we're going to talk about Romania, and a number of other topics. So just bear this in mind, bear what we heard today in mind about the wonderful progress of the human race. Just keep that in the back of your mind so you don't get extremely discouraged on the episode tomorrow. Make sure you subscribe to the show on iTunes or Stitcher, because I release a new episode every single weekday. Just give me half an hour a day, and my guests will make you a smarter libertarian. TomWoods.com is the place to go to check out the show, the archives, the hundreds of episodes, the show notes pages, all kinds of free resources waiting there for you at TomWoods.com. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.